I think it's starting to record now. So I think it's starting this year.
Okay,
so my first question for you, it kind of revolves around your research, because I've read a little bit about it.
So
it's, how has your lab's understanding of oxidative stress and neuroinflammation evolved over time in the context of Alzheimer's progression?
So, you know, oxidative stress and neuroinflammation kind of go hand in hand through the mitochondria, and so we're just learning more and more that preventing too much oxidative stress, because, you know, you do need oxidation for the whole body to work properly. It's when you have too much that you get these accumulation of ROS and the accumulation of the bad markers of oxidative stress. And the same with neuroinflammation. We've just learned that that's really a key focus, and we believe that that can even start prior to the onset of dementia. So one of, as I told you, one of the things we really study is prevention. And what we can see with like traumatic brain injury, which happens to be a risk factor for dementia, that traumatic brain injury just sets off this neuroinflammation that just kind of keeps going. It's chronic neuroinflammation, and over time it just gets worse and worse and eventually leads to dementia.
Can you explain the science behind the neuroinflammation? Like, how did you find out, like, that was the key factor that led to early onset?
From doing traumatic brain injury studies. It's not the only way, but, like, we found that after a traumatic brain injury, there really wasn't anything, like, on under the skull, but yet they still had the dementia. And when we looked in the centers of the brain that are highly involved in memory, we found that there was increased neuroinflammation. And we also found that if we blocked that process from happening, that we could prevent the dementia.
Okay. What role do you think trauma-related factors like traumatic brain injury play in accelerating Alzheimer's pathology compared to just aging alone?
Oh, yeah. It plays a big part, because it accelerates the factors that lead to dementia. So, and it doesn't just, so of course it accelerates the neuroinflammation, but it can also, it can lead to other things, which depression, which can also lead to neuroinflammation, and a lot of things like that. When people become depressed, they become isolated, and isolation is another factor that speeds up dementia. So it's kind of, it's multifactorial.
What do you think trauma-related factors play in accelerating Alzheimer's disease?
The disease itself?
Yes.
Well, so traumatic brain injury increases, it causes neuroinflammation, and the neuroinflammation can also, it also increases tau, which is what is hyperphosphorylated, and it also, tau and A-beta are really kind of interrelated, and they kind of feed off each other, and once the cycle starts, so it appears that it, through those factors also being correlated with or interacting with the neuroinflammation, that's what speeds it up, because that process just starts happening earlier.
And you mentioned something about the tau. I researched a little bit about that, so there are a lot of things that go wrong in Alzheimer's, like amyloid buildup, and then
correct,
the tau tangles, and then inflammation and oxidative stress. So how do you decide which one to specifically focus on when you're designing treatments or experiments?
Well, everybody started a lot with just targeting A-beta. And there are some A-beta treatments now, like the vaccines. The thing about them is that they have to be started like 10 years before the development of dementia. And while you can see that on a scan, most normal people that don't have any problems going on aren't going to go get scanned. And so clearly it's involved in the process, but we are finding that it's a little harder than we thought. You can't target it once the dementia's onset. It seems to be better if you target it before. And then tau, one of the reasons that people focus on tau, especially in humans, it's they can have the plaque and elevated A-beta before they get dementia, but it seems like when they start getting the tangles that that's when humans start showing the increase, or when they start showing the increase in dementia. For us, we kind of have looked at what things we see in the brain and then say, okay, if we target this, what happens? If we target this, what's happened? So it's just sort of looking at the whole anatomy and just seeing what changes have occurred.
So with that, what would you say is like the biggest challenge out of it all?
In terms of when it comes to humans or when it comes to... I mean, the thing is that, especially for a treatment that leads to humans, is when you do an animal study, it's very controlled. You can control so many factors, and you can't control what goes on in a human. In fact, really, you don't always know what's causing the dementia, and sometimes you have to sort, they usually have many things going on, so they might have high blood pressure, or they might, so they have some vascular dementia going on along with the Alzheimer's. So that makes it very difficult. And especially in humans, it's just difficult because there's so many things, and really the multifactorial aspect of it plays a big part, excuse me, in the human dementia.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that it would be better to experiment in animals then?
Well, that's what we do. Yeah, because then we can say, okay, we know this factor is involved.
Mm-hmm.
So we can help identify what's involved. And then those are things that you can then can look at and target in a human. But you have to know that there are going to be some differences, not just because there's differences in the brains, but because they've had different experiences and you don't exactly know. Because to a certain degree, especially the sporadic Alzheimer's disease, which is really 96% of Alzheimer's, it's sort of an accumulation of insult. And each person has different things that's gone on with them that have led to this.
Okay. So when testing novel compounds, what does the path look like from early findings to something that might be clinically available today or in the future?
Well, first, there's something, you have a target that you want to hit. So then a biochemist will develop a drug, a chemical biologist will develop a drug, and they will go through, you know, looking at it in cells and running PKs to see, you know, to try and optimize sort of a dose range. And then once you get past that, it does things in the cells that you're trying to target, and you know what the, you know, the lethal dose is and what the, you know, what the 50% dose is, then you sort of do a dose response curve in an animal to see, for us, to see if it improves learning and memory. But then we also will look at, you know, the what we're targeting, so the beta amyloid or the tau, to see if that changes as well. And once you get to that, it actually has to be done in three different species. Following that, then you can move it into a phase one clinical trial, which is just a small group of people. And once that works, then you can go to phase two. And then phase three is a broader, where you do a lot of people. And then once it gets past that, then the FDA will approve it for humans.
Yeah.
So it generally takes about 10 years for something to go from something somebody created. Some things have been fast-tracked. But, and then there are things where you repurpose a drug, so you don't have to develop the drug, but you realize that along with doing whatever that it was initially used for, that it might also work in another disease. So metformin is a drug that is for type 2 diabetes, but that also has some positive effects in patients with Alzheimer's disease. Some of the sphingolipid drugs actually are right now being targeted for Alzheimer's, looked at for Alzheimer's disease. Those are the drugs they actually use in MS, multiple sclerosis.
So you mentioned that it takes a long, long time for a disease to, or a treatment to even be designed and clinically available.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that's on the way? Like, just curious, like anything we could probably possibly see in maybe the next few years, like 5 years, maybe?
Well, again, the sphingolipids, which are mm-hmm. the ones used for things like the MS, metformin, but that one has seen mixed results. I'm sure they have some of the vaccines in clinical trials. I know that the tau vaccine is in a clinical trial. They may come up with a beta vaccines that might be able to work closer to the onset of dementia. I don't work in that particular area. Also, there's been some development in antisense oligonucleotides, which are out there trying to, they basically bind to the nucleotides and stop the Watson-Crick mechanism from occurring so that they don't create the peptide that is causing the problems.
So it's a very long process.
Yes.
So how does your lab model aging, or how does your lab model aging or Alzheimer's in a way that closely reflects the human condition?
So we do use mouse models. Mm-hmm. We have a mouse model called the SAMP8, which mm-hmm. is senescence accelerated mouse. Okay. That is, they have all of the characteristics of Alzheimer's disease, but it's not just one genetic change that causes it. So you have transgenic models, which somebody manipulates a gene and then they overproduce a beta or a tau or whatever. And this particular model just spontaneously develops it. It's one of the few actually... It's one of the few models of sporadic AD. And so for us, we are at sort of the end of the road where you're looking to see if you actually get improvements in learning and memory. And then we use tasks that are sort of as closely relevant to a human, like a spatial task, because as you know, when somebody gets Alzheimer's, they start wandering and they get lost. We use recognition tasks. But then we also, you know, check... we have a lot of controls, so we check to make sure we're not just affecting activity or making them, you know, more hyper. There's a lot of things you have to look at to show that this change that you're doing in the brain is really causing the improvement in learning and memory.
Yeah.
And again, then we also verify it biochemically and histologically.
So your lab is very interesting and very tedious, I presume. So I'm curious, how did you know that you wanted to study Alzheimer's?
So I got into the field of behavioral neuroscience, mm-hmm. and I happened to be in a lab studying sort of how hormones affect behavior, and across the hall from me was somebody who studied aging and dementia, and he said, come work for me. And then I got into it, and I found it extremely interesting and exciting, and so...
Okay.
You just go out and try things out, and then, you know.
What do you wish high schoolers, or just youth in general, better understood about brain health or neurodegeneration?
Oh, well, that what you do when you're young does affect what happens when you're old.
Right, yeah. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about this, that just because we're young, it doesn't really matter what we do. It's an old people.
Correct.
Kind of disease. I've heard that a lot, so.
Yes.
Yeah. Are there any findings in specific that you found that you wished others to know, like the internet, like, or anything?
Goodness. Yeah, I mean, I have looked at things like exercise and diet and things like that, and those do definitely play a part in brain health and in dementia and in memory and things like that.
So lifestyle definitely does play a big
role. Absolutely. But also, you know, and vaccines are actually very important.
Yes.
Regular vaccines, not just the vaccines for the targets in AD, but vaccines like tetanus, the TDP shot, all of those actually guard against development of dementia. We think it's because just a normal T cell response, immunity response against guarding to protect the body.
Yeah. Okay. What are some common misconceptions you hear about Alzheimer's disease or aging that your research challenges?
No. You're saying it properly. So many people call it Alzheimer's. I'm like, there's no T in the word.
Yeah.
It's a joke. But anyway, misconceptions. Probably that it can't happen to me, you know. I think that's the whole thing. Another thing that's important is education, because the more you have in your brain, the more you have to lose. So that's also another thing that's important, keeping your brain active, being knowledgeable, all that kind of stuff actually helps out.
Yeah, okay. And then do you think public education has kept up with the science behind Alzheimer's disease, and where are we still falling short in bridging that gap, if not?
Public education is a broad thing, and there's certainly certain places that are a little better than others, but I wished really that they just offered more opportunities for students to sort of be in a laboratory environment, or if they're interested in medicine, to maybe be able to be around that sort of environment. And I think that certain school systems promote that more. And I think that that is kind of, in terms of what they're teaching, I have a son who just graduated high school, and I felt like they did an okay job of, you know, teaching him. I mean, it's important just to get the basics of how the brain works before you can understand what's going wrong. You know, it's just, there's these natural processes, this is how things have to occur. When you have Alzheimer's disease, that doesn't happen. In terms of, you know, in the human perspective, I mean, but I don't know that if science, you know, just that once they get it, they're not, you know, it's horrible and they're not doing it on purpose. They can't stop it. It can sometimes be, I think, frustrating when you're around a person who can't remember and you're like, why are you doing this? You know, why are you not, why can't you remember this? And, you know, and they can't help it.
Makes sense, yeah. That's it of all my questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Actually, wait. I don't want to miss out on any questions. No, no problem.
I can probably check if I have any. Let's see. Yeah, I think that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I hope I answered your questions.
Yes, you did. Very well. I hope this is recorded. Okay.
So, yes.
Yeah.